This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Big show this week, big time for movies. It is kicking off the official summer movie season, and I'm going to be talking about Captain America, Civil War, Bite, Tale of Tales, Phantom of the Theater, and Riff Tracks Time Chasers, which I had a chance to see this week. I'll also talk about some news, the trailer park, and of course another interview from Time Chasers, this time with the director, David Giancola. And I'll also give my box office predictions and the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. Let's jump right into the news, and I'm ready to just drop some politically incorrect truths on the blogosphere out there, and because that's really where all the real analysis of movies is happening. I mean, forget Hollywood Reporter and Variety and these published pieces, then they have their own online sources. It's all the stuff that happens on the online community and Twitter and Facebook and these different movie sites that is really driving the conversation, especially in Hollywood. Case in point, I'll address that in the second example I've got here. But the first thing that happened this week that set the internet afire was the Power Rangers. Of all things, Power Rangers costumes for the new movie were officially revealed, and people lost their freaking minds over it, over the Power Rangers. Now, if you don't know anything about the Power Rangers, there are these, like, martial arts sort of Inframan type characters from this TV show that ran from, like, 93, and it's kind of been in continuous production with different casts. They always just wore spandex. Well, they're making this big movie, and they've got, looks like plastic armor. It's meant to be metal, but it's plastic. And people are freaking out about it because the female outfits have boob plates and wedges, essentially high heels. And people are saying, oh, isn't this terrible? Look at what sexist pigs people are in Hollywood. All the girls have to be running around in high heels and they gotta have boob plates. Okay, first of all, there's a reason they do high heels a lot of times. It's because women are generally shorter than men. And a lot of women that are in really good shape that can do this athletic stuff tend to be really short. Scarlett Johansson is a great example. She's not a tall person. In the whole history of cinema, there's always been high heels on a lot of these outfits. Batgirl in all the different forms. Batgirl's taken her Catwoman. Or Wonder Woman in the most recent Superman movie. And anytime Wonder Woman's ever shown up on screen and in the comic books, they've all had high heels and fought in high heels. And they continue to do so. Even Black Widow, in the scenes in the Avengers movies, she's fighting in high heels, and she's got external boob and butt enhancement type things. I mean, they maybe don't have breastplates on there, but she's wearing leather and a zipper that goes all the way down so you can see her cleavage. And I read in a publication that I respect. They were like, well, you know, Power Rangers have always been non-gender specific. I'm like, that's not true. Now, there have been a certain overall generic look to them, but the part of the reason for that was a budgetary issue, because when they originally started making the show, they would intercut the Japanese shots with the American shots, so they just kind of wanted to have generic-looking Power Rangers so they could intersplice those and not have to reshoot everything for the English-language market. So they padded everybody down so they had the same level of athleticism bodies. But they've always been gender-specific. The pink and the yellow Rangers have almost always been girls. I don't know whether they've had high heels, but they've certainly had skirts before, which aren't conducive to fighting martial arts. Plus, this is Power Rangers. It's not Captain Phasma from Star Wars. It's a silly little kid show. And they look relatively normal to me. They just look less spandex and more armor. This is not something to get upset over. There's way more things to get upset over in this world. Now, in a similar sense, whitewashing has become a big hot-button issue now. And there's been a pseudo-apology from Scott Derrickson, who directed Doctor Strange, for casting Tilda Swinton as an Asian character. And also, there's been a big hubbub about Scarlett Johansson being cast in the Ghost in the Shell live-action remake, which was originally a Japanese movie, and she's playing basically a Japanese character. These are two different things. First of all, Tilda Swinton is playing a generic character who happens to be a horribly racist stereotype from the comics. This is old, wise, Asian dude, and that is probably equally as offensive as not casting an Asian person for it. It's sort of like when they did the Mandarin in Iron Man 3. No one's happy, and you couldn't be happy because if you cast an Asian person and had him play the Mandarin from the comic books, that's a horribly racist character. Ghost in the Shell was greenlit because of Scarlett Johansson. It hinges on her box office appeal, which is what they always do, male or female. They always base it on box office appeal. They did that with Julia Roberts and Reese Witherspoon, Sandra Bullock in the past. This is not uncommon. And part of the thing is there's no real big name Asian actress right now. 10 years ago, Hyunsee Lee probably would have been cast in Ghost in the Shell and everyone would have loved it. 20 years ago, maybe Michelle Yeoh would have been cast. And maybe people would have been upset because they're Chinese and it's a Japanese story, but at least they're Asian, I guess. And on the same token with Doctor Strange, 10 to 20 years ago, Jackie Chan probably would have been cast in Doctor Strange without question. It's about star power. It's not about skin color or race. Finally, the last piece of news is Avengers, The Infinity War, Parts 1 and 2 are going to get a name change. The directors have said, the directors of Captain America Civil War, the Russos. And they've basically come out and said, yeah, we're going to change the name. And look, I called this a while ago because after recent issues with the Part 1, Part 2 moniker in movies, where Hunger Games suffered severe box office depression over the two films, and then Allegiant just did poorly all around, I think people have grown wise to this whole Part 1, Part 2 thing. And I remember saying that back then, and now they're coming out and saying, no, Infinity War is not going to be a Part 1, Part 2. We're not milking one story into two movies. They're going to do two movies. They're doing Avengers 3 and Avengers 4, which is what they're originally going to do. When they can, though, and I'll bet you anything, same thing's going to happen with Justice League if they ever get that onto the right track. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to hit is Bad Moms. This was one I was asked about this on the radio because there's a host who was like, oh, all my friends are moms. And so they all went crazy over this trailer. It's written by the people who did The Hangover. And it comes out on July 29th.
The bake sale. No BPA, no MSG, no BHA, no BHT, no sesame, no soy, and of course, no nuts or eggs or milk or butter or salt or sugar or wheat.
No.
What's that now?
I'm so tired of trying to be this perfect mom. I'm done.
You said everything I've ever felt about being a mom but couldn't say.
There's so many rules now.
Don't punish your kids.
Don't say no to your kids.
Be bad moms.
Oh, I'm in.
To bad moms.
This is a frustration most normal people feel. I have a theory that this sort of super mom doesn't exist. People like to pretend they are, and there are people who will put up a good front, and they'll only put the good stuff on Facebook, but you can't do everything that the super moms are supposedly doing. But because of blogs, because of Pinterest, because of social media, people have this perception that other people are doing it. And you're getting that frustration being expressed. I'm Mr. Mom. I take care of my kids. I've taken care of my kids ever since they were little doodle sockers. And I don't do stuff the way most moms do. I don't care. I don't sit on Pinterest and feel guilty about it. I'm like, I don't care. When you stop caring about what other people think, it puts you in a certain level of power. And I think that's what Bad Moms is going to tap into. The next one I want to hit is The Magnificent Seven, which opens on September 23rd. It's directed by Antoine Fuqua.
So you seek revenge.
I seek righteousness. But I'll take revenge.
Took a job looking for some men to join me. Is it difficult? Impossible.
Quite a batch of strays.
This is not going to end well.
I'm excited about this simply because I love the director so much. I think he's a fantastic director, and he's one of the best ones out there, and he doesn't get enough props. This is a remake of The Magnificent Seven. I think it's going to be a good movie. I'm looking forward to it. It looks like it's going to capture the grittiness that it needs to for a modern Western, but it also has a little bit of a lighthearted nature. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Riff Track Live Time Chaser event, plus an interview with the director. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. I'm going to be doing a little bit slightly different review than I normally have done in the past. Fathom Events has, with digital projection, it's put itself in theaters and it can do live shows and it can do special broadcasts. But what's neat about Fathom Events is it's a satellite streaming technology that allows you to see these live productions. I know they've done Shakespeare plays. They did A Winter's Tale. And I saw A Winter's Tale. I didn't see it at the live show, but it's a neat thing. You can literally watch the production as it's unfolding in England. Well, probably on tape delay because you're not going to be watching it at 6 a.m. But this week, the good people of Riff Tracks have done a Time Chasers event. And Time Chasers I talked about last week because I interviewed one of the stars. And it's an old movie, the Sci-Fi Channel type movie. It was made in 1993. And it came out to no acclaim whatsoever. And it was put on Mystery Science Theater back in 1997. And they brought it back to Riff Tracks to do a live show, brought select people from the cast and crew out to Nashville when they did the live show, and I had a chance to see it. But I interviewed the director, David Giancola. He had some really neat things to say just about the process of independent filmmaking in the 90s and going into these riffing productions and then dealing with Riff Tracks and what might be in the future. Go back to 1997. You've done this movie in 1994 and it shows up on TV. What were your first thoughts when you heard about it and then when you saw it?
People don't generally know this on the business side of things, but they don't just take your movie and throw it on the show and make fun of it. Sure. They license it. So I got a call from my distributor. And my distributor said, I got good news and bad news. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, what do you want to hear first? I said, start with the good news. Good news is you're on the Sci-Fi Channel. I said, what's the bad news? He said, well, it's Mystery Science Theater 3000. And I said, well, that's not bad news. We're fans of the show. It can be, you know. So that's how I found out about it. And then we actually had a bunch of the cast and crew over, not everybody, but most of us. And we watched it the night that it premiered.
Did everyone tend to like it? Good sports about it? Do we get a Joe Don Baker moment? The rumor was when he saw Mitchell, he didn't.
He went nuts. Yeah, that's what I heard. No, I mean, I'll tell you, for me, it was a weird experience because I knew the show and I knew what they were capable of doing. But then it becomes your movie and it gets personal real fast.
Yeah.
You know, and actually it was funny. The laughter didn't start until about 15 minutes in. I remember specifically we were all sitting there. But then the laughter started, and I think Peter Harrington was probably laughing the loudest.
Okay.
And then we got into it, and it was a lot of fun. And even the fans, when they're replicating even the toughest of jokes, it's in good humor. You know, being on Mystery Science Theater 3000 raised the profile of the film immensely into a true cult status that it would have never had any other way.
What do you look at it 20 years later now that you're that far removed from the film itself and that far removed from the original riff that went on with Mystery Science Theater?
You know, I have fond memories of the whole thing, and I still meet new fans. So when I look back on all that, it's sweet memories to be sure, but I have to admit, even without the guys riffing the film, I watch the film and cringe because I, as any director does, you see nothing but mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, and my company owns 15, 16 movies, so it's really weird that I've got movies that cost $3 million sitting on a shelf here that I can't move to anybody. Mm. And my little $150,000 movie from that was shot in 1991, released in 93, is still out there, and it's having a bigger release than anything I've ever done.
Did this give a boost to your career, either back in when it first hit Mystery Science Theater or right now? Are you getting a little bit of traction for this?
I think it's given a boost to my IMDb rating, and kind of the fan side of it, but it's not like people going, oh yeah, I want to hire that guy who on from Riff Tracks or Mystery Science Theater. He's the cultural genius that I want to direct my next epic. No, it has not helped my career. But I also know what's going to happen. They're all going to be pitching me Time Chasers 2 when I get down there. No
do you want to do that? Is that something that you would be up for?
You know, I've said no, and the reason I've said no is because I'm not the 19-year-old kid anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm not that innocent. I'm not the same person I was, so I couldn't make the same film. I wouldn't want to try and make something that's intentionally cheesy because I don't believe you can create that cult thing. Mm-hmm. It just happens. I mean, this whole process of Time Chasers becoming a cult movie and being riffed and having all this, I didn't really control this, and I really don't feel in much control right now. Mm-hmm. You know, I really feel like I'm on the merry-go-round and trying not to get thrown off. And I don't aspire to be the next Tommy Wiseau, let me be clear. And you know what? The film has gotten a life with regular fans, you know, for the non-riffed version because of its riffing, because it wouldn't have reached them otherwise. And it's really interesting how, you know, with time travel movies, they're kind of an unusual subgenre of their own, and people who like time travel devour everything time travel. And I ended up running into a fan just last week, and she asked me a question about the time-space paradox, maybe a bit of quantum physics, and I was kind of panicking because I'm thinking, I don't know the answer to this, and I wrote the movie.
You weren't just like, it's just a plane, man.
Yeah, I almost wanted to say it's just a movie, but that's not cool. You can't say that. You know, no. I don't know. Maybe it's a plot hole.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Thank you so much, David Giancola, and the folks at Riff Tracks for getting that set up. It was kind of neat to talk to this guy because I remember seeing this movie back when it came out on MST. Now, let's just talk about the film itself and their version of the riffing. The story basically follows a physics teacher who develops a way to travel through time using an airplane and must fix the damage he inadvertently does to the future.
It's time for Riff Tracks.
This May comes a flick so deliciously cheesy, they're coming back for seconds.
You wanna fly? Let's fly!
Welcome to Psychotic Flight School.
Join Michael J. Nelson, Kevin Murphy, and Bill Corbett live for the sci-fi classic Time Chasers.
Suck it, bikes. Get some more wheels, you nerds.
Rift Live, May 5th, with a special rebroadcast May 17th.
One of the neatest things about this specific experience was you actually got a chance to see some deleted scenes reintegrated in the film, because when they did Mystery Science Theater, they had to cut it to time. And the movies themselves, even if they're only 90 minutes, there was, like, I think about an hour, 40 minutes a show when you took out the commercials, and then they had 10 or 15, 20 minutes of host segments and their own credits. So they oftentimes had to edit their films down, not just for content, but for running time. So you got to see the full version of the movie. And I mean, there's some stuff that was cut out that's not good, but, you know, it's kind of entertaining. It certainly is entertaining with the riffs going on. I mean, they have the travel to the future. They do a little bit more with that, and they have this weird cab driver that the heroes connect with. So it's neat to see the movie in its entirety, which has been available, and it's going to actually get a Blu-ray release coming, I think, in September. They also, like most Riff Tracks presentations, they had a short film. It's like a 10-minute short film back from the 40s or the 30s called Chimp the Fireman. And this is where the real heart and soul of Riff Tracks is, I think. It's not just the big movies, and it's fun to see the movies. I know they got a Star Wars The Force Awakens version out there. But these short films, these crappy public domain, nonsensical movies that you don't even understand now, looking at it in 2016, what this purpose was for this film. It's about a chimp that just goes next door to a fire station and gets a job. This would have been perfect for Carl Pilkington, Monkey News. In fact, there was a Monkey News segment on the old Ricky Gervais show about a firefighting chimp. Maybe this person sent this in based on this short film. But what's neat is the jokes are different in this version of Time Chaser, so you can still enjoy the old Mystery Science Theater version. They may have pulled their punches a little bit because the cast and crew were there, and you could hurt people's feelings. But still, one of the things I love about Time Chasers is it's one of the more watchable MST movies that's out there. There's some movies that make it to MST that are impossible to watch without the jokes, that are nonsensical or so boring. There are some that are so boring they're hard to watch with the jokes. But Time Chasers is actually this, it's cheesy and corny, but it's this kind of neat little time travel movie from the early 90s.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Anyways, they will be doing a encore presentation of this on May 17th in theaters. You can get tickets. Go to rifftracks.com, and you should be able to find a link there, or Fathom Events. That's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, Captain America Civil War and Bite.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling into the film reviews. Now, of course, we're going to talk about the big movie that everybody's talking about that's taking the world by storm, and that is Captain America Civil War. The Avengers are split with loyalty when the government attempts to rein them in and gain control of their organization because of collateral damage.
Captain, people are afraid.
We need to be put in check.
Whatever form that takes, I'm game.
I'm sorry, Tony.
If I see a situation pointed south, I can't ignore it. Sometimes I wish I could.
Sometimes I want to punch you in your perfect teeth.
We're not perfect. But the safest hands are still our own.
This film is directed by Joe and Anthony Russo, who did The Winter Soldier. And you definitely see their influence in here, because when they did The Winter Soldier, they said, hey, let's not just make this big explosive superhero movie. Let's do something that's more of a political thriller, kind of like 3 Days of the Condor, the heroes on the run. And while there's big fight moments in The Winter Soldier, it's much more restrained. And as in general, when you look at these superhero movies, Marvel has been really good with that. Instead of saying, hey, we're just going to have cities getting blown up in every movie. Because this is like the 13th Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. So instead of having everything blow up, they say for these other movies, maybe the big action piece is just going to take place in this one location and it's going to be about the people. And let's not have everything blow up a city, which is something DC hasn't learned yet. But at the same time, it also addresses the realities of these giant superhero battles. You can't have had the destruction that was wreaked in the Avengers by Loki and those alien slugs from outer space, where you had buildings exploding and things crashing in and just laying waste to city blocks. There's collateral damage there. There's real people getting killed, even though it's a PG-13 off-screen moment. Now, you had that also happen with Avengers Age of Ultron. And they point this out in this movie where they're like, people are getting killed. Real people are dying. And there's collateral damage. And you can't just go in there willy-nilly and do this and then leave and let people mop up. So they're addressing real moments. And they address it a little bit better than they do the PTSD moments that they have in Iron Man 3. Because they have a little more even tone. And that's the whole purpose behind this, is to kind of bring the Avengers films into a bigger world, a more realistic world, and bringing up issues that people would really have if this stuff were indeed happening in real life. While it does that in a very sober moment and in a very subtle hand that the Russos have, and especially that first half of the movie plays out very much like The Winter Soldier, where it is this tracking somebody down, it's not big explosive battles everywhere. They do have a big superhero smackdown, and that's because the lines are drawn in the sand, and the good guys have split. You got Team Captain America and Team Iron Man, and each has their own allies, and they're trying to track down the Winter Soldier who's tied to this whole conspiracy. Of course, Cap is trying to save him because they're boyhood buds. Which leads this into playing out much like a Avengers movie part 3. This is not an Avengers movie, but it is an Avengers movie, because you've got Captain America and Iron Man and Iron Patriot and Black Widow and Hawkeye and Scarlet Witch and Vision. And now you've got some new characters. You've got people like Black Panther. Now, of course, they're doing a Black Panther movie in a couple of years, and I'm still not 100% sold because the character is so serious. Part of what's fun with these movies is they have a certain lightheartedness, even in some pretty harrowing times. But I'm curious to see where they go. There's a lot to explore with the Black Panther. And I think they're going to be tying a lot of the Black Panther movie in with what happens in this film. So they're setting the stage for even more Marvel movies. Marvel is not done. This is the 13th Avengers series movie, but they got a lot more ahead of them. The only Avengers you don't have are Hulk and Thor. And that's okay, because that, it just doesn't feel as crowded as Avengers Age of Ultron did. And I also don't get the sense that the Russos have been burned out. It took two movies to burn out Joss Whedon. It took two movies to burn out Jon Favreau. These are the only directors that have directed more than one film. Now, the Russos are going to be directing the Infinity War series, which hopefully they aren't burnt out, because this mirrors the comics. When you open a comic and you'd read a comic, they'd have characters show up from other books. And just because Iron Man would show up doesn't mean everyone has to come to him. And it makes sense, because Bruce Banner's on the run, and Thor's doing his own business in his own world, having his own stuff that it's going to be doing, because they got Thor 3 coming out. But this also brings in the new Spider-Man. That's one of the big news about this movie. Tom Holland is Spider-Man. We get a lot more than just him showing up once. It's a very welcoming, let's bring in the new guy. And of course, you've still got everybody kind of making the jokes and the quips. You've got Tony Stark being a bit sarcastic. You've got Spider-Man, who doesn't take everything seriously. You've got Ant-Man showing up, who doesn't take everything seriously. But it also does return to that Captain America flavor. It's a very well done movie. And who knows, it might be one of the last times you really feel that Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans are into it, because through the Avengers 3 and 4, they're going to be just fulfilling their contract. But that, of course, brings the bigger question. What are they going to do? They're going to have to recast. I hope that when they end Infinity War, they just don't kill off these guys, because they're like, well, we can't replace. You're going to have to replace them. These are Doctor Who characters at this point. But I'm going to say Captain America Civil War, it's got everything you'd want. It's got a really good story. It's got great characters. It's got realistic portrayal of things. I mean, it's still a superhero movie. But it's also got the big explosive action. It's got the superhero smackdown. It's got the quips. It's got the comments. It really is that whole package. This hybrid between an Avengers movie and what you had with Captain America the Winter Soldier. So I'm going to say Captain America Civil War totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Bite. This is a smaller film released by Shout Factory. Body horror, which is a whole subcategory. If you don't know horror movies, body horror is a fascinating subcategory in the genre. After a trip to the tropics for her bachelorette party, a woman comes home with an infected bug bite that takes over her body.
Something bit me.
Aw, are you okay?
Yeah, it's just a little bite.
Hey, have you been sick at all since our trip?
I'm fine. It's just a small bug bite.
Well, it looks infected.
I need to speak to a doctor as soon as possible.
Casey, you're scaring me.
But what happened?
She's a monster.
Who is?
Casey!
This is a relatively small, intimate movie. And actually, I was terrified when I started watching it. Now, it has nothing to do with horror elements, but it started out as a found footage movie. She's in the tropics for her bachelorette party, and there are all these friends who have video cameras, and they're editing it together. And I remember getting 5 minutes into this movie just going, oh, dear God, this is just going to be another crappy found footage movie. That was just the setup. When she gets back home, it goes to a traditional shot film, which is great, because found footage has just been done to death, and I don't see any original elements to it anymore. I thought it was a cool little bait and switch that they did in the movie, though, where you thought it was found footage, and then it turns into something very different. And, this is, in a lot of ways, pays homage to The Fly, David Cronenberg's The Fly, which is a grisly body horror movie, extremely gory. Even Videodrome has body horror elements. I remember when Tusk came out last year, as uneven, as silly as that movie became, it actually had a really good way of becoming a body horror movie, because it's the guy physically carving up a guy and turning him into a walrus. And then it just goes completely pear-shaped and stupid. And that movie ended up not being very good because it had only half a good movie in it. But this one actually really works. And again, paying homage to The Fly, having very specific elements, tearing off fingernails and that sort of thing. It's a grisly, unsettling movie and very dark, but very contained, because most of it takes place in this apartment. Just her entire life disintegrating and turning into something horrible. And it's gory. It's extremely gory, but it's almost like, and I'm not to say it's gore for gore's sake, sure, because it's just, I mean, just dripping with slime, but it's not gratuitous. It all makes pragmatic sense within the telling of the story. It has a little bit of goofy plot twists to it. But overall, I mean, Bite's definitely worth seeing, especially if you're into body horror and you're into just modern horror films. So I'm going to say Bite totally rocks as well.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Tales of Tales, Phantom of the Theater, the box office, and of course the home cinema roundup. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, finishing up the show. Got a couple more films to review. The first one is Tale of Tales, three intertwining stories of passion and deceit in adjacent kingdoms tear families apart.
Every new life calls for a life to be lost. The equilibrium of the world must be maintained. Are you willing to accept the risk?
I am prepared to die in order to feel life grow inside me.
Hunt a sea monster. Cut out its heart. You will become pregnant.
The husband of a princess can only be discovered through a tournament.
What if I don't love him?
You will.
Anyone who knows me and knows my love of horror films knows that I love the anthology horror films, even the crappy ones. You know, even stuff like, I mean, Nightmares is a terrible anthology film from the 80s. But I mean, of course, the granddaddy of them all is Creepshow. And I've talked about anthology films just a couple weeks ago. Did a Fat Guy 5 on them. But I love the old Amicus horror, and I've been recently watching old episodes of Night Gallery on MeTV, because that's essentially it's an anthology show, but I mean, they're at the level of Amicus. I saw that this was a anthology movie of some sort, and I stampeded right towards it. I requested to see it. And, you know, this is a very different take on the anthology movie, because it is not just one story wraps up and goes to the next one. They're intertwined. They're basically three separate storylines woven together, and they'll be at one, and then they'll hand it off to another story. And we've seen that before. In other movies, Sin City's kind of like that. If you've seen the Sin City movies, they move from story to story at times and hand off the narrative. And that's very much the same way with this. Now, this is, of course, a classic tale. It's not something like by Stephen King or films that are based on like easy horror comics. It's an adaptation of a Neapolitan poet who wrote these back in the 18th century. So there is a certain level of history that's associated with this that you don't normally get with anthology films. And that's kind of part of what makes it interesting. Now, it's an Italian production, but it's English language. So it's much more accessible to the mainstream of America. And it has mainstream stars that you'd recognize. Salma Hayek's in it. John C. Reilly's in it. You've got Toby Jones in it. Vincent Cassell, who's a little bit more of a European known actor, but they're familiar faces to this, but it does have that vintage period piece look to it, but it's weird. And that's the thing that's so cool about it, is it's horror stories before horror stories became what they are in the modern sense. I mean, even going back to cinematic horror, like, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein, or even Nosferatu, or the Gollum, these silent films, it predated that by like over 100 years. And that's kind of what's neat about watching it. It's like watching old Nathaniel Hawthorne stories come to life. But don't let that period piece element steer you away from it, because it is just as strange and as bizarre as a modern movie. One of the stories about a queen played by Salma Hayek who wants to become pregnant. So on the advice of a soothsayer, she sends her husband down to battle a sea serpent to cut out its heart. And so if she eats the heart, she will become pregnant. So it's this weird, I mean, witchcraftery type thing in this kingdom. And there's this one about this guy who basically falls in love with this flea that turns into this, I mean, dog-sized flea, and then ends up selling off or marrying off his daughter to a horrible person. And then, of course, the third one's about these two old women who are wooed by a king who's all lustful. And there's these messages to it where all the characters, their downfall is ultimately vanity or lust or obsession. And it's all those negative seven deadly sins that cause the angst and the horrible things to happen in their lives. It's a neat movie. It's very different. It's worth seeing simply because it's different and it's quality and well-made. So I'm going to say Tales of Tales, like the other films so far this week, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent. Yay!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Phantom of the Theater. Now, I don't have a trailer for it because it's in Mandarin. And you wouldn't know what they're saying unless you speak Mandarin. I don't speak Mandarin, so they could be saying horrible things, and the subtitles could be wrong, for all I know. So I'm not going to play that on the air. But the story is about a would-be director who plans to film a subversive movie in a haunted theater where a tragedy happened 13 years ago. It's a Chinese production, and it's steeped in Chinese culture. Whenever you get one of these, especially a fantasy or a horror film, from a culture as different as the Chinese culture is than the American culture, there's a gap you have to bridge. And I've seen enough Chinese thrillers and horror movies to at least sort of make my way across that bridge and get what's going on. But there's still a lot of stuff cultural and etiquette wise and interpersonal and history of, because it's a period piece. It takes place World War I-ish, I think is around when it takes World War I, World War II. And this movie is essentially a ghost story. It starts to get a little bit melodramatic halfway through, which is not uncommon in Asian movies. But it does hold together, and it has some very creepy moments, has very effective moments, has moments of ghosts, but it also has a real story behind the story. And it's sometimes a little bit hard to keep straight who's who, because some of the characters aren't terribly well-defined. There's a lot of characters that are essentially two different versions of the same type of character, and that can get a little confusing at times. But overall, it's a neat movie. It's visually stimulating, and it's a neat little thriller. I believe it's only in a subtitled version, so you can catch it in limited release. I know it's opening in Columbus, Ohio, my neck of the woods, this weekend. Anyways, Phantom of the Theater kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Box office from last week. I said that Jungle Book was going to make $35 million, and I was under, actually. It made almost $44 million, which is really good. I mean, considering that's its third week of release, and it's made $43 million for a movie that opens in April. It's at well over $250 million going into this weekend, but it's going to fall to Captain America Civil War. Of course, I don't think Disney, though, is too worried about it. With Zootopia and Jungle Book and now Captain America, the first half of this year, most of the box office weekends have been dominated by Disney. But the Jungle Book is going to drop, and it's probably going to drop pretty significantly because it's now has direct competition with a Disney adventure movie being a Marvel film. So, I mean, it's going to be 20 million or less. But people don't know how much Captain America is going to do. I mean, the first two Captain Americas made under 100 million this first weekend. I mean, the first Captain America made like 60 some million its opening weekend. Winter Soldier did well, but again, Winter Soldiers didn't even crack 300 million in total box office. The Avengers movies are really what you want to benchmark this against because it's playing like an Avenger movie. It's got the anticipation, it's got the release date of an Avenger movie, plus it's got, with the exception of Hulk and Thor, it's got the Avengers in it. But it's leaner. It's not as bloated as Age of Ultron. And whereas Age of Ultron didn't crack that magical $200 million number, which was seen as a bit of a disappointment, even though that's a massive number, this one, I think, has a really good shot at it. I honestly would not be surprised if it's 210 to maybe even 220 million. I could see it beat the Avengers and Jurassic World in its pre-sales. I went to the theaters on Thursday night to go see Time Chasers, and it was packed with people on Thursday night to see Captain America. I mean, this movie's going to have you know, it's sure it's going to be front loaded, but the good word of mouth will push it at least 200 million. I'm just going to say just conservatively 200 million for Captain America, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's over 210 million. I don't think it's not going to reach the Star Wars number of 250 million. It's not going to crack that, but it's going to do really well. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Real quick roundup this week. There's not a lot of big stuff out there. There's The Fifth Wave, which was terrible. That's the one with Chloe Grace Moretz and alien invasion, dystopian future. Teen movie, well past its time. Nobody's going to be making these movies. In 5 years, people will forget that these were a big thing. Remember, which is a fantastic movie, actually. Smaller film, came out in theaters a couple weeks ago, talked about it, gave it a great review. It's about Christopher Plummer playing a survivor from a Nazi concentration camp going after, he's got dementia, but he's going after another survivor who was a Nazi and trying to seek revenge. Very well done. Very well done. If you haven't seen Remember, check that one out. There's also Joy, which was with Jennifer Lawrence, directed by David O. Russell, about the woman who made the mop. Kind of fell between the cracks. I enjoyed it. I actually liked it better than some of the other stuff David O. Russell's done. But then again, I'm not a huge fan of his. There's some vintage stuff coming out. There's Independence Day, the 20th anniversary edition. So you can brush up on that before the sequel comes out this summer. Airwolf, the complete series, which is very different than Blue Thunder, the other helicopter series. And The Last Ship, season 2. That's it for this week. I need to take off. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the Money Monsters, The Darkness, and High Rise. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.